Hi, my name is Robert McMahon. I'm the Connection Director here at Covenant Church, and I'm thrilled that you're listening. If you're checking us out for the first time, welcome. We're so glad that you're here, and I'd like to take this chance to invite you to let us know that you're tuning in today. We'd love nothing more than to help you start building meaningful relationships and to join you on the journey of faith. Just go to bgcovenant.org/connect and let us know how we can be in touch. With that said, let's dive in and listen together to this week's message. Good morning. Welcome. Happy New Year, just about. My name is Robert McMahon. I'm the Connection Director at Covenant. And today I am tying a bow, if you will, on our Christmas sermon series. But Christmas is this week and it's over now. I know. But I believe, and I hope you'd agree, that the hope of Christmas doesn't end on December 25th. So I hope this is a helpful lead into your new year and a wrap up of Christmas. I won't be reading the Christmas account from Luke chapter 2, so you don't have to worry about that. But I will be reading from a familiar prophet that we often hear quoted at Christmas, Isaiah. He's the guy who wrote, "For unto us a child to be born." And as I've been studying Isaiah in preparation for today, what I've come to realize is that before the people of God had Revelation, the Jewish people had Isaiah, that they're very similar kinds of books. We'd started a sermon series in the book of Revelation before we started doing Christmas, and we'll continue that again later this year. And one of the common misconceptions about Revelation is that it's too difficult to understand. Its meaning is hidden, when in reality, Revelation was a letter, a book written so that it could be understood. It wasn't written to be hidden. It was written to be understood by the original readers, and we can too. And the same is true of Isaiah. Excuse me. It's often even referred to in the Jewish tradition as the vision, which is similar to what Revelation looks like. It's all one big vision, and Isaiah is called the vision as well. And through the visions and the images and pictures that are laid out throughout Isaiah, Isaiah also has a clear and understandable message. And it's this: God doesn't forget his promises. Though Israel, the people of God, who the book's written to, is stubborn, there's story after story of the Old Testament where they're disobeying and not following God and doing all these different things. They're stubborn, but they're not abandoned. God does not abandon them. Though God's people often turn to everything other than God for hope, God is still their ultimate hope, even when it looks like all hope is lost. So we're going to be looking specifically at Isaiah chapter 11, where God lifts the eyes of his people who are in exile. They're not a flourishing nation at this point in time, like God has promised that they would be. He made a promise that they would be a flourishing nation, but he does point them toward hope, not by ignoring their current reality, but by revealing what he's doing under the surface, what he's doing behind the scenes. And he reveals that, Isaiah writes, through, surprise, a picture, an image, a metaphor. And the picture is this: a stump, a root, and eventually the fruit of ultimate hope. And the promise for them is the same for us today. Even when it looks like all hope is lost, God has not abandoned us, and he will fulfill his promise to rescue the world and restore peace once and for all. So, let's dive in. Isaiah chapter 11, verse 1. Isaiah writes, "There shall come forth a shoot from the stump and branch, and a branch from his roots shall bear fruit. And the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. And his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. He shall not judge by what his eyes see, or decide disputes by what his ears hear, but with righteousness he shall judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. And he shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall kill the wicked. Righteousness shall be the belt of his waist, and faithfulness the belt of his loins. The wolf shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the young goat, the calf and the lion and the fatted calf together, and the little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze, their young shall lie down together, the lion shall eat straw like the ox, the nursing child shall play over the hole of the cobra, and the weaned child shall put his hand over the viper's den. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. So some things are happening there. There's stumps. There's a righteous king who judges righteously. There's animals. And so the first thing to note as we start to make sense of all of this today is that to Isaiah the prophet, and this applies to all the Old Testament prophets, he sees both his time and is speaking to his people, but is given a vision to see future events, but he sees them all as one big future. But for us, thousands of years later, we actually have an advantage to Isaiah. We see more of the picture, and we've seen that some of these things have already started to take place, such as, unto us a child is born. We just celebrated that. That has already happened. That wasn't in our passage, but it's something that he also wrote. But then we read this part about the animals, and I don't know about you, but I don't see cows and lions playing very nicely in the wild. Scholars sometimes call this prophetic perspective, where for Isaiah, he can't distinguish. We look at a mountain range, and you can see there's different peaks in the mountain range. But for Isaiah, when he's given his vision, he sort of sees it from this angle, and all he sees is one thing. And so he doesn't distinguish between this, then that, then this. He just says, I don't know, all of this will happen. So for us, what we've seen in this passage is that there's a coming righteous king. And we just celebrated that this week. He came. He did come. And who is he? And then the second part of the passage we read is about the coming peace on earth. And what will he do in the end? Because we haven't reached the end yet. He has come, but we haven't reached the end yet. So who is he? And what will he do in the end? So we'll start with the stump. What's with the stump? Well, Israel, essentially at this point when Isaiah is writing, looks metaphorically like a forest that has been clear-cut. Because like kings before him and kings after him, King Ahaz, who's the king of Judah at the time of Isaiah's writing, King Ahaz crumbled in fear from the attack of the north. And what did he do? He relied on the strength of a foreign nation to be his protection, their nation's protector, rather than trusting that God would be their protector. Not to mention all the injustice going on in the nation, false worship, and things that just happened over and over again all throughout the Old Testament. And eventually, Isaiah is describing, God lets it all come crashing down. He said, you're not trusting me. We're starting over. And they go into exile. They're taken over by these foreign nations because God is to be their hope and nothing less. God has promised that he would make Israel a great nation. We've said this. And this nation would have an eternal righteous king. But from their perspective, at that point in time, it looks like those promises have failed because they're not a nation at all. Isaiah 11 answers the question, what if the tree's just gone? Isaiah is not written to a people on the rise. It's written to people staring at a stump. Chapter 11 continues this theme that has been written in Isaiah 9 and 10 leading up to chapter 11 of this divine forester. There's this picture of God as a divine forester. Isaiah illustrates God's wrath as cutting off branches like a forest fire in chapter 9. And then Assyria in Israel's place rises up. But for them too, Isaiah writes, these are the final verses right before chapter 11. He says, "Behold, the Lord God of hosts will lop off the boughs with terrifying power," talking about Assyria. "The great in height will be hewn down, and the lofty will be brought low. He will cut down the thickets of the forest with an axe, and Lebanon will fall by the majestic one." Those are the final words of chapter 10. Chapter 11, a stump. Only this time it's not Assyria, it's Judah, it's Israel, it's God's people. They're a stump. And it's a continuation of this imagery of the divine forester in his purifying pruning. This is the aftermath of what the Lord is doing. But his promised eternal king and the righteous king has not been forgotten. There is still life in the stump, which is why verse 1 then says, "There shall come forth a shoot from the stump." There's still life there. But it's immediately interesting that Isaiah reaches beyond David. Because what does he call it? It's not just the stump of David, it's the stump of Jesse in the text that we read. The promise that I keep talking about, the promise of this eternal king, that was made to David when David was alive. We even call it the Davidic covenant. That promise was made to David, so why is it the stump of Jesse? Jesse is David's father. What Isaiah seems to be doing is because the kingly lineage of David has been so corrupt, just king after king after king, we're hoping, is this the promised king? Nope. Is this him? Nope. Nope. Fail. Idolater. And so rather than promising just another king on this long line of corruption and bad kings, he says, we're going to have a new David. Right from the source, the original promise will be a new David, not just another one. He will spring from the very roots of the dynasty. And even more interestingly, at least I think it's interesting, do you know where Jesse lived? Bethlehem. And of course, we know now, it's literally Jesus who springs forth from Bethlehem. I think that's cool. But for now, it's a stump. Israel has been pruned by the divine forester. And for many of us, I feel like we've just gotten a history lesson on Israel. But for us, we know what it's like to look at our lives and feel like we're looking at a stump. Dreams that maybe didn't deliver on the promises you'd hoped, hopes that feel hewn down. And sometimes we feel maybe abandoned by God when it might actually be God's pruning. It might actually be preparation for new life, true life, to grow unhindered by the dead wood that would ultimately likely be in the way. I have a friend who even has told me that they pray for their kids to have a hard time so that they would ultimately depend on Jesus. They pray for their growing, soon-to-be adult kids, "Would you just make it quick? Break them so that they depend on you." That's a weird prayer, but it's not a bad one, I think. Let me explain it this way. Over the next couple of months, maybe even today, tonight, tomorrow, I don't know. Winter's coming, I think. It was here and then it was gone. I don't know what's happening. Winter's coming. The coldest months of the year here in Northwest Ohio are the next couple of months. But just a few months ago, many of us were enjoying pumpkin picking, apple orchards maybe, because why go to the grocery store and buy a bag of apples when you could pay more to pick them yourself? This is what we do for fun. But if you go there right now or in the next couple of weeks, it looks not so pretty. It looks kind of grotesque. It looks gnarly, lifeless. Trees are cut back, branches are on the ground. And to someone who doesn't know what they're looking at, it looks like destruction. But a grower knows something that the casual observer doesn't. If you don't prune these trees, the plant will still grow, but it won't grow healthy fruit. It'll waste energy on dead wood, and it will produce less life. Isaiah 11 is written to people staring at the aftermath of God's pruning. Israel looks like a stump, but God is not absent. He is at work below the surface. And God's pruning in our lives often doesn't look quite the same, like he's punishing us. Often it looks like something has been lost, something we were leaning on, hoping would provide life and goodness for us, and then it's just gone. Maybe a role that you've played in your life, maybe that's in your family or your career, a role has just changed or been gone. Plans that you've made for your life, control you thought you had. I've certainly walked those sorts of roads before. After college, I landed my dream job. Went to school to be a band director. Right out of college, got a band director gig. 6th through 12th grade, great little school district. I was the man. Look at me, I did it. Only to realize it didn't ultimately satisfy this desire I had that I didn't know for approval, because it wasn't God. Only God could approve of me in the way that I was hoping my career might, or the approval of my parents telling me, good job. I felt like it all slipped away. I felt like I climbed the wrong ladder and found no life at the top of it. Even good things can quietly become things in our lives that replace God as our ultimate hope. And God's people didn't lose everything because God forgot them. They lost what was no longer producing life. Dead wood that just couldn't hold the weight of God's better promise for them. God had better things ahead, and that's where Isaiah turns next. So, when the stump is all that's left, the question becomes, what kind of life will grow from it? What will be different? And Isaiah's answer is not to try harder, do better. His answer is a person. A shoot from the stump, a king whose goodness doesn't come from the right circumstances or a good reputation or force of power. This king's goodness comes from the Spirit of God himself, direct from the source, the root. Look at the way he's described in verse 2. The Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. It's the Spirit. And some scholars suggest, similar to the way Revelation is symbolic at times, that this basic description at the top, the Spirit of the Lord, followed by three pairs of qualities attributed to the Spirit, is intended on purpose to add up to a symbolic seven. And in the Bible, seven is this number of perfection. And so it would suggest that this king would perfectly reflect God himself. Not just a list of good things, God things. In other words, he's not drawing from his own strength, he's empowered by the very heart of God. The root is drawing from the right source, nothing less than God. And when the root is right, the fruit follows. When the root is right, then the fruit will follow. So we know who he is. Now what will he do? What is the fruit? Well, verse 3 calls him righteous, which looks like equity for the meek, consequence for the wicked. He doesn't judge with his eyes or what his ears hear. He's not playing image games or rumor games. His judgment is genuine. It's truth. That doesn't sound like good news, but that's good fruit. No corruption. It's true. It's real. It's protection for those who would be vulnerable. And then he continues with more in verses 6 through 9 with an absolutely beautiful picture of a redeemed creation where the new king will do what only God can do. Not only among humans with right judgment, but his rule will subdue the earth where Adam failed at the beginning. Here's where Isaiah sees one mountain, but we can tell this part hasn't happened yet. We call him the Prince of Peace at Christmas, Jesus, because this is what happens when the truly rooted king returns. He came once, and when he comes back, this is the sort of thing we can expect. All of creation will respond. He pairs this pairing of strong and weak, just like in the judgment where the meek and the wicked will be judged righteously. Here we have more pairings of strong and weak. Perfectly at peace, the wolf and the lamb, the leopard and the young goat, the calf and the lion, a little child is leading them, the cow and the bear, the young, the lion and the ox. Children are playing with snakes. The earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. All creation will respond. This is where history is going. The reign of Christ, who came once and is coming again, will ultimately change the whole of creation. Paul writes in Romans 8 that creation is groaning in anticipation of this. Because in the new heavens and the new earth, variety will become harmony, not enmity. And in the new creations, in the new earth, the weak and the strong will be complements, not enemies. God's reign is all-encompassing. There's no part of neighborhood or nature that is beyond his renewal. All crookedness will be corrected in all of creation. This is where history is going. But it's also what Christ has already begun. But the fruit only comes when the root is right. And so often we get it backwards and we obsess over the fruit without trusting the root. We see flickers of this, regular flickers of this ultimate hope that we're hardwired to have. We want things to be new. We're excited about the new year, fresh start. But we also kind of want to be the hero. Social media feeds are full of DIY ideas of how to be better. There's new books releasing on how to have better habits. It's time to set your New Year's resolutions. I don't know if you're a goals person. And I'm not actually hating on these things. They're good. Like I said, we are hardwired to want these things. That is a good hope. We have a real ultimate hope of better. But as a card-carrying member of Achievers Anonymous, can I challenge us all not to just resolve to be better in 2026? Because our hope isn't in becoming a better branch. Our hope is in staying connected to the root. And this is Christmas. He came to be like us. Why? So that we could prove to him that we could be like him? No. He came to be like us because we can't be like him. We need him. But without him, we can't get there. When we forget Isaiah 11 and the message of Isaiah 11, we need to hear Paul, what he tells us in the New Testament, in Galatians 3. Check this out. How foolish can you be? After starting your new lives in the Spirit, why are you now trying to become perfect in your own human effort? Isaiah 11, verse 1 says that he shall bear fruit. But who's bearing the fruit? He is. He shall bear fruit. He who began a good work in you will bring it to completion. John 15, Jesus picks up this language and then sort of finishes the sentence from Isaiah 11. He says this, "Remain in me, and I will remain in you. For a branch can't produce fruit if it is severed from the vine. And you cannot be fruitful unless you remain in me." So as we head into a new year, here's a simple, honest question for all of us. Where am I trying to produce fruit without staying connected to the root? What's one area in your life? Not your whole life, just pick one area. Where's one area you are striving in your own strength instead of resting in his? Maybe it's parenting, your work, faith, control, proving yourself. If it feels exhausting, brittle, or performative, it might be an indication of a branch trying to live on its own. Or maybe what's one practice you can start to remind yourself to remain in Jesus? This doesn't have to be complicated. It might be starting the day with 10 quiet minutes, inviting God into the rest of your day. It might look like committing to look at Scripture before you look at your phone. It might be a short prayer that you return to maybe on your way to work or when you feel anxiety just spiking. Jesus, you are the vine and I am the branch. My life is in you. It can be that simple. And whatever you choose, maybe you start fasting. It's not to earn credit with God. It's not extra credit. It's just to stay connected. Or maybe you know that there's at least one dead branch that you need to let go. Maybe it's a habit that's numbing pain but isn't producing fruit, and you know it. Maybe it's a pace that impresses or a standard God didn't ask you to meet. Remember, pruning is not a punishment. It's preparing room for real life, for true life to spring forth. So wherever you find yourself today, on the edge of another new year, have hope. Jesus came once, and he is coming again. And until that day, we don't manufacture fruit. We stay rooted in the root because he will make all things new. And even now, he's growing something good inside of you. Would you pray with me? Lord, I'll be the first in line to confess that I often rely on my own strength to find satisfaction, to prove myself to any number of things, rather than relying on you. So would you help us all as we step into a fresh start, a fresh year? Would you give us the attention, the little nudges from your Spirit to remember you, to remain in you? We need you. We're grateful for you. We need you in 2026. In Jesus' name, amen.